You're listening to Screen Heroes on the Heroes Podcast Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Screen Heroes, your TV and film podcast here on the Heroes Podcast Network. I am your regular host, Derek, and I have with me my two lovely longtime co-hosts, Ryan.
Hello.
And Ray.
Hey.
Hey, hey, hey. Welcome back. Welcome back as we enter our next year of podcasting. Last year was our 5-year anniversary, and now
season six.
We've had multiple seasons because I did a season break after, like, when we would take a week off or something. So this is season 10, volume 10. It's kind of like Family Guy or Survivor.
Well, we do two a year.
So yeah, here we are in our sixth year and our 10th season or whatever. And Merry Cagemas to all of you.
That's out right. There, ho, ho, ho.
With me and out there.
Our Lord and Savior, Nicolas Cage, is our focus this month. God above all.
It's true. We are doing 3 Nicolas Cage episodes back to back. This week is 1997's Con Air. Next week will be Ghost Rider, which is a little more in our wheelhouse. And then we are going back to 1997 for Face Off.
And you may be asking yourself, why not do our Christmas episode, Nicolas Cage? Well, that was our plan until Wonder Woman 1984 ruined that plan. So thank you very much, Warner Brothers, for fucking with my entire month of Cage movies.
I don't feel too bad about it.
I do.
I'm sorry.
You couldn't have pushed it 1 week? Come on, for us?
So that's our main topic. At the end of the show, we'll be talking about The Mandalorian Chapter 14, The Tragedy, in our new format that we launched a few weeks ago. But we kick things off, as always, with some news. And this week, we've got two main topics we're going to cover. One is Warner Brothers and the HBO Max debacle, so to speak, and Spider-Man 3 casting. And not that Spider-Man 3, the new Spider-Man 3. So there you go. Let's kick things off with the Warner Brothers stuff. So as Ryan said, they announced that Wonder Woman 1984 would be dual releasing in theaters and on HBO Max on Christmas Day. This was exciting for a lot of people. This was frustrating for some people as well. And then to shock the entertainment world, Warner Brothers announced that all of their 2021 films, all of them, would be releasing in theaters and HBO Max on the exact same day. Now, some of these movies include Godzilla versus Kong, the new Mortal Kombat movie, the new Space Jam, Suicide Squad, Dune, Matrix 4, many, many others. There's another Conjuring movie that's in the works. There's the Tom and Jerry live action-ish film, just a bunch of films. We're talking well over a dozen different films from Warner Brothers that will be dual releasing. And this has caused a firestorm from some directors, from some studios, and some fans as well. So guys, what do you think? Good decision, bad decision? What do you think?
Well, the decision works out in my favor, so I am prone to saying it was a good one. Now, honestly, it comes down to business, and if this doesn't help them out financially, then they're going to say, no, it was a failure. And directors like Patty Jenkins and Christopher Nolan and James Gunn are going to be even more upset and probably a little I told you so. But if it turns out that this gets a ton of HBO Max subscribers and people are still seeing them in theaters, just, you know, at a reduced amount, then everybody's good, you know? They're gonna say, well, I guess this is the future of cinema. And I hope it is. Like, there's a lot of stuff that this pandemic has pointed out to us. And I think the way we consume media is largely at home. So why not consume as much of it as possible at home?
Yeah, I mean, it's a decision that's been pretty divisive among, like, the people that are set to make money from studios or streaming services. But for fans, I haven't seen a lot of controversy, except from people that are pretty hardcore, like theater people that just like really love the theater experience and think there's no way that it can match for anybody. But I mean, HBO Max as a streaming service is not very successful at this point, compared to, you know, Netflix, Hulu, or like Disney Plus, partially because they've had this like falling out with Roku, where they've been unable to work with each other and come to a, you know, meeting point that works for both of them. And that's a large amount of people use Roku. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's really hurt them in terms of their subscribership. But I think with this, Roku pretty much has to play ball with them, or they're going to have a lot of upset people and people that aren't using Roku anymore. But, you know, I think this will pump up the subscription numbers. Will it do it as much as they hope it will? I mean, it's hard to say at this point, but, you know, it'll be interesting to see. And like, yeah, like you said, Rachel, I'm a fan. I'd rather, you know, I like the theater experience sometimes, but there's, in the last few years doing a lot of movies with you guys, I've been more disappointed going to theaters than I've enjoyed it, because, you know, you get the guy next to you with a smart watch. Every time he moves his wrist, his watch is like a flashlight in your eyes, or like they're on their phone, or they're talking, or popcorn hits you in the back of the head, or, you know, kids screaming. You know, there's a lot of things. People are just generally kind of shitty and don't care about anybody other than themselves. So the theater experience is not as pure for me as it is for a lot of other people. And, you know, even Alamo at this point has had some issues with, you know, with their viewing experiences. So there's really no safe place to go and have and know you're going to have a good movie watching experience. Yeah. Except, man, at home I can, right? Like I can pause it and go take a piss or get some food or whatever and not miss anything. So
yeah, I mean, even when we saw Endgame, one of the times we saw it was at Alamo, and a chunk of the movie was interrupted for me because the two people next to us didn't actually have tickets and argued with management in the middle of the movie because they refused to leave their seats.
Yeah. Oh no, that wasn't it. They brought food.
Oh, they brought outside food?
Yeah, they brought outside food. Their server told them that they served that same food, and they wouldn't put it up or throw it away, so management had to come and talk, and it like they argued with them, and it was disruptive. So
right, but even like with their cell phone policies, if somebody gets on their phone, it still requires a manager or somebody to come in and tell them to shut their phone off, which is disruptive to your movie going experience. So like Alamo tries to have all these rules, but even just enforcing those rules will ruin the movie going experience for other people. So
yeah. And literally every time at AMC, it's a problem. Somebody is on their phone at some point during the movie at an AMC theater. And I have gotten into confrontations with people multiple times over it because it's just incredibly frustrating. They get really pompous about it. And you know, so I'm with you. I definitely prefer watching stuff at home, and you know, maybe I would make the jump to 4K if that was going to be a regular thing. You know,
well, we'll be for a year, so you know,
well, that's true.
So it might be worth the upgrade.
So it just, well, so to be fair, Warner Brothers kind of left a little asterisk on the whole deal and basically stepped back and said, well, if things change dramatically, we'll adjust as the environment dictates. That's a paraphrase. So just if, let's say, you know, we all get this vaccine in February and March or whatever, you know, if it's this crazy great opportunity and the pandemic is behind us by July or August, we may not see the fall films do this. They did kind of leave that door open. And the big issue,
I can't
really
blame them. I mean, of course they're going to do that, right?
Well, and the big issue here has the way the studios and some of the directors and actors work is, you know, they get a cut of the box office take. So Legendary, which is responsible for two of these films, Godzilla versus Kong and Dune, they basically, from their perspective, are saying they weren't consulted in this conversation at all, and they get a percentage of the box office haul. A lot of actors like Gal Gadot and directors like Patty Jenkins for Wonder Woman 1984 get a percentage of the box office take. And if there is no box office take, or that box office take is cannibalized by the movie dual releasing on a streaming service, it starts to beg the question of how are those contracts going to be reworked or worked in the future, right? Because a lot of the ways studios get around even more intense budgets are those back end deals.
It's true, but I mean, on the other side of that token, you know, the companies that are financing these movies and everything, that's put, you know, $250 million for a superhero movie, are just sitting on that money that's been spent and they can't do anything with it. And yep. So, you know, Patty Jenkins might get screwed out of some money, but also the studio is getting screwed out of some money. And, you know, if there's no studios, then there's no jobs for actors other than indie films. And people don't traditionally, you know, go see a lot of indie films. So, I mean, it's bad on both sides.
I will say Gal Gadot and Patty Jenkins have nothing to worry about because apparently the two of them worked out a special deal where they're each going to get an extra $10 million.
Well, that's not bad. That's enough to help me sleep at night.
So
they're like, you know, that scene in Zombieland where Woody Harrelson is like crying, but he's like wiping his tears with $100 bills.
Yeah, so they're going to be okay, you know. But some of these smaller productions that Legendary is responsible for, you know, there's some bigger questions there, right? And then you have somebody like Christopher Nolan, who's basically been Warner Brothers' sweetheart director for over a decade, coming out and not only being firmly against this plan, but straight up saying that they have the worst streaming service. That's a quote. He said, quote, I'm just going to read this real quick. Quote, some of our industry's biggest filmmakers and most important movie stars went to bed the night before thinking they were working for the greatest movie studio and woke up to find out they were working for the worst streaming service. Now, I get, like, you know, grammatically what he's going for there, but I feel like it's a little extreme to call it the worst streaming service. There's some rough ones out there. It's certainly not the best, but he's not helping himself any.
Well, I mean, as we talked about in our chat, he's kind of the one that, you know, put the nail in the coffin with this. He had to push and push to tell, you know, Tenet has to be seen in theaters. It has to be seen in theaters. And then nobody went and saw it in theaters. Like, I mean, some people did, but not enough to make any money. And so the studio ended up, you know, losing a good chunk of money on that. And so that probably was the final nail in the coffin for Warner Brothers. And, you know, so he really at this point has himself to blame. He took a gamble and the gamble did not pay off.
Yeah, it's a really good point. And Twitter hasn't held back in reminding everybody of that, because he continuously pushed for that movie to come out. It was delayed three separate times in short stints and came out to basically a nothing box office. There wasn't all the theaters weren't open yet. There wasn't anything else really out. You know, Bill and Ted did a simultaneous release to VOD. You know, that's how we watched it. So I put a lot of this on Christopher Nolan too. If you're going to spend $200 million to make a movie, which is what Tenet supposedly cost to make, you can't just say, well, you know, we're cool with what we took home if it's significantly less than that.
Exactly. I'm surprised it hasn't hit HBO Max yet.
There may be some other VOD licensing deal to work out there. Because one of the small notes that I think a lot of people are missing is that these movies will be on HBO Max for the first month, and then they go to VOD for a while.
See, I'm not sure that people are missing that. I just think they're like me and they don't really give a crap, because in 30 days, if you can watch the movie as many times as you want, then you're probably going to be sick of it for a while, you know, and not want to watch it again, unless it's just an absolutely stellar film. And, you know, these movies don't have a lot of overlap with the other movies. So really you'll have, you know, Suicide Squad out for however many weeks, you know, by itself, and you can watch it as many times as you want in 30 days. Not to mention the fact that the pirates of the internet will have those things up for anybody that wants them immediately after they're released. So not that we encourage that or condone that here at the Heroes Podcast Network, but, you know, there's a lot of people that do partake in those illegal pirating activities, and they can keep it for free for however long they want.
Yeah. I more meant people who are like, well, we'll get to it, thinking it's just going to be there.
Sure. But I don't, I don't know. I mean, 30 days is a pretty long time. I feel like
I'm not complaining. I just, yeah. You know, it's more of just something to be aware of. Is there anything else on this topic we would like to discuss before moving on?
I was just going to say it works out in our favor as a podcast as well as viewers, because we can rewatch the movie over and over again and get different viewpoints or find stuff that we missed, which is much more difficult when you have to go to the theater.
For sure. And also we can ask our viewers to watch it so they can come discuss it with us. And we don't really feel like we're asking them to spend a ton of money, mm-hmm. you know, or anything like that. They probably, a lot of them probably already have HBO Max. So.
And HBO, a month of HBO Max is less than the price of one Dolby ticket here in Kansas City.
Yep.
So there you go.
So you're saving money.
All right. So let's talk Spider-Man, Spider-Man 3 specifically. So who wants to do this one? I've been talking a lot.
Okay, so first of all, I feel like it's going to be called Spider-Man Into the Home.
Into the Homeverse.
Into the Homeverse. Okay, so there's a ton of people that are coming back from the Sony movies. There's J.B. Fox's Electro. There's both Andrew Garfield and Tobey Maguire as past and present ghosts of Spider-Man. And then there's both the leading ladies, Emma Stone and Kirsten Dunst, as Mary Jane and Gwen Stacy. So here's my prediction. Siren Ray 2021, Spider-Man Into the Home has already cast Miles Morales behind our back, and they're saving that. And Donald Glover will be back as Prowler. And surprise Nicolas Cage cameo as Spider-Man Noir.
Mary Cage missed to us.
You just stole my thing. That's all that was.
I'm sorry, but we're married. We have communal things.
I'm going to go on the record and say I think that Rachel is wrong about all of those predictions except the Nick Cage one. But I think that my prediction is that Willem Dafoe is definitely going to come back also.
God, I hope so.
And that they're just basically doing what we've talked about. They're just trying to set up the Sinister Six, and that's what the movie is going to be about. I think if you introduce Miles Morales and Prowler and stuff like that, it's going to be a whole different movie. It's going to be way too close to the animated and the Spider-Verse movie. This is already going to be close enough, but that would take it to like live action remake level practically.
I think this is secretly a backdoor pilot for new Spider-Man Noir.
Do you think that Wilson Fisk is coming?
Oh man.
No, I think it's too much. I think that they're already going to be cramming this thing with villains. There's no way that they're going to, I mean, it would be, I would love it. Don't get me wrong. I want that to happen, but I don't think it will.
Part of me expects a lot of this to be like Crisis on Infinite Earths though, where like some of these people are going to be in like a scene.
See, I don't think so. I think this is going to be the Sinister Six as the villains. So, I mean,
and they're just taking the best ones.
Yeah, they're taking ones that are already established. And then it's actually a pretty creative way to do it, because we've already had these characters established in other movies in the past. So they don't have to make a new movie with these characters to get you to care about them or know what they are. They already have that.
The funny thing is, out of all the characters they've confirmed, you know, only two of these, or no, I guess half, three of these people are still alive. You know, spoilers for movies over a decade old, but Electro and Doc Ock and Gwen Stacy are big old deadsies.
Doc Ock, you don't really, do you see the body?
Well, he floats down into the water. Movie. I think we're supposed to believe that he's dead. But I mean, you know, Willem Dafoe, you know, Green Goblin's dead.
Yeah. But he's not announced yet.
Well, no, but we were talking about how we thought that he would be. So yeah. I guess I just figure like with having Tobey Maguire, Spider-Man, and like just having three Spider-Men in the movie seems like a big task. So part of me thinks like those other two universes are going to be a very short kind of thing.
Maybe the Spider-Man parts. I don't think Tobey or Andrew Garfield are necessarily going to be playing a big role, but
I mean, it's been almost, it's been 20 years since Toby started as Spider-Man.
He's going to be old man Spider-Man. It's going to be like the Logan Spider-Man story now.
It'll just be called Peter.
Yeah. Nice. Which works.
Nice. I like it. I'm good with it. I don't know. I think that part of that this is them trying to do a live action version of Into the Spider-Verse, because I don't think they ever anticipated that idea going over as well as it did, because that movie's amazing. And so a lot of this seems like that's what they're trying to do.
I don't know. I don't think that they're gonna like do Prowler and Kingpin and all those like they did in the Spider-Verse.
Okay, so do you think they're gonna connect Morbius and Venom?
It seems like a missed opportunity not to connect at least Venom. We haven't seen Morbius yet, so I'll hold off on that. But it seems like a mistake not to bring in Tom Hardy's Venom.
Yeah, I agree. I think that would be... Or they could just bring back Topher Grace.
Look, there's only one thing that should be brought back from that movie.
And it's Sandman. The dancing.
Well, it's been fun.
All right, peace out. I don't want to talk about this movie anyway.
Why oh yes that? You do.
Oh, you mean Con Air. You mean Con Air. I thought you meant Spider-Man. Is there anything else on Spider-Man before we move on?
What's your favorite Spider-Man villain from all these movies? Is that, because we know Alfred Molina is a big one and he was in the best Spider-Man movie. So is he your favorite, or is like Michael Keaton your favorite as Vulture, or like you know, where do you guys rank?
I think my favorite is probably Thomas Hayden Church's Sandman, because his story was written so well, and he would have been a great character in a good movie, but the fact that he stood out and gave such an amazing performance in a bad movie says a lot.
That's true. So you prefer him to even Alfred Molina?
I don't know. It's difficult because everything was like amazing in Spider-Man 2, minus James Franco.
He was fine. Yeah, it wasn't horrible, but it certainly wasn't good either. What about you, Derek?
My favorite is Alfred's Doc Ock. That's my number one.
Yeah.
Willem Dafoe's Green Goblin and Jake Gyllenhaal's Mysterio are my other two in the top three.
Michael Keaton is low for you.
It's nothing like against him. I don't think Homecoming is that great of a movie. I think Far From Home is far superior. And I think that it's my favorite Jake Gyllenhaal role of his career that I've seen. And I haven't seen all of his stuff, to be fair. And I've always been pretty hard on him. But his Mysterio comes out as one of my favorite characters in the whole MCU. So I really wish they had taken it in a slightly different direction so they could keep him around like all the time. But
you mean like starting a multiverse where he can come back?
Well, no, first off, we don't know that he's really dead, but I more meant like actually have him be a good guy and be a mentor to Peter. I thought would have been a really cool reimagining of the character. And he was so good in that role. And he's great as the villain too, but yeah. So those are my top three. The exact ranking varies a bit, but Doc Ock's always at the top.
That's good to know. Yeah, I mean, I kind of feel the same way. Alfred Molina's like number one for me. And Michael Keaton was great, but he was the best part of that movie, but that movie wasn't great. So, mm-hmm. You know, it's tough to put him in the likes of somebody that's one of the best superhero movies of all time.
Spider-Man 2 holds up. It really does. It's still one of my favorites. Both Spider-Man 2s are good.
all three, you mean?
Oh, you know what? Okay. I haven't seen Amazing Spider-Man 2.
Fair enough.
So there you go. All right. Anything else, guys?
No.
All right. Then we are going to take a short break. And when we come back, we will be talking 1997's Con Air starring Nicolas Cage. We'll be right back. All right, guys, we're back. Let's do this. Merry Cagemas. Let's kick things off.
Merry Cagemas.
So, Ray, this was your first viewing of Con Air?
Sadly.
Definitely not our last, though.
She really hated it a lot more than I thought, but we'll get to that, of course. Ryan, you've seen this movie, obviously.
Of course, yeah.
Okay. Ray, did you know that it was nominated for 2 Academy Awards?
My fucking God.
It didn't win. It didn't win either of them. But yeah, it was nominated for Best Sound as well as Best Original Song.
Oh, for How Do I? Yeah,
How Do I that Live? Makes
yeah. sense. Yeah. Yeah. Now, it was nominated. Steve Buscemi was nominated as Best Supporting Actor for a Saturn Award. So there you go.
Blockbuster Entertainment gave Nicolas Cage. Oh, wait, that was for Face Off. Never mind. I thought that he got favorite actor that year, but I think it was specifically for Face Off.
It did win what's probably my favorite Razzie category, which is Worst Reckless Disregard for Human Life and Public Property, which I feel like Michael Bay must have won every time he's made a movie, right?
And also,
Man of Steel.
It also got nominated for Worst Original Song for How Do I Live. So it got nominated for Best Music Original Song from the Oscars, but for Razzie, it got nominated for Worst Original Song for the same song.
It was nominated as Best Songs Written Specifically for a Motion Picture or for Television in the Grammys, which apparently was a category. So
wow.
It's a mouthful. So this movie is all over the place. Okay. 6.9 on IMDb. It boasts kind of a crazy cast. So
yeah, the cast is insane. Like, like if I saw a movie coming out this year that had this cast, I would be so excited.
So you've got
beyond excited.
You've got Nick Cage, of course. He's the lead. You've got John Malkovich. You've got John Cusack. You've got Ving Rhames, Dave Chappelle, Danny Trejo, Colm Meaney. You've got
Steve Buscemi.
It's really a massive cast. It's kind of striking how many people are in this movie. And it is basically all dudes. There are 2 women in the entire
film. And they aren't worth anything. Like, they don't do anything worth anything, really, in the whole movie.
I guess there's a 3rd woman who works for Cusack.
Yeah, does she even have any lines?
I don't think so.
Yeah,
so
that part of the movie isn't great.
What are your overall thoughts, Ray? Because I know that you're unhappy with it.
Giant pass.
Care to elaborate on this podcast where we speak?
Where we talk about movies?
It's bad.
Why is it bad?
Come on, man. Like, did you see it? Were you watching? Like, everything's bad. The dialogue is bad. The character names are bad. The CGI fire in many spots is very bad.
You don't like the names?
Diamond Dog.
No, she doesn't like the criminal names.
The nicknames.
Cyrus the Virus.
Right, like that's gross.
Gotcha. Okay. Sorry. I was like, Colm Meaney's character is Duncan Malloy. It's fine, you know. Like, I don't love it or hate it, so I was just curious what you meant.
So why are they gonna give him a super Irish name but make him not use his Irish accent? Like, what the fuck?
He talks like he does in Star Trek.
No, he doesn't. He uses his Irish accent in Star Trek.
He maybe lays it on a little thicker, I guess, at times. It varies a bit.
No, he used an American accent in Con Air, and he uses an Irish accent in Star Trek.
I mean, I guess because he works for the DEA, they wanted to make him sound American.
Then why not just have his name be like John Smith? They straight up had him have a very Irish name.
I mean, to be honest, it sounds like we were being very nitpicky right now about something about the movie. Like, well, you can say the dialogue is bad, that's fine. The dialogue is bad, that's fine. It's a movie that came out in 97, so CGI fire, not great. But CGI fire wasn't great in any movie in 1997. You know, dialogue is bad is really the only thing that I'm hearing from you that's a real criticism that's not nitpicky. Personally, that's my interpretation.
So the general premise of the movie is that Poe, played by Nick Cage, goes to prison for manslaughter, basically in self-defense. He kills one of 3 people who jumped him and his wife. And when he gets out, he is on his way to go home on a prison transport that is hijacked by a bunch of lifers, which are led by John Malkovich and Ving Rhames. And they Nick Cage is trying to save the day from the air while John Cusack is on the ground and kind of has an antagonist in Colm Meaney's character, who's also trying to get the plane down, but doesn't care if everybody dies. Is that a pretty good summary?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, I mean, the premise is a little silly in parts, right? Let's face it. There's a couple of things about it that aren't great. The idea of putting so many high profile, highly dangerous convicts together on a single transport isn't great. The idea that there's no like contingency for the plane being lost doesn't make a lot of sense to me, simply because there are a lot of contingencies on the plane. You've got the different gates. There's no weapons allowed on board. I would assume those things are so the plane can't get taken over. So that thought process has at least come up at some point. So you'd think there'd be maybe a backup transponder somewhere hidden that wouldn't be public knowledge or something like that.
I mean, to be fair, it's a 90s Jerry Bruckheimer movie. You know, Armageddon, he didn't direct it, but he produced it. That had a stupid ass plot too, and everybody loves that movie. Totally. You know, why would you send a bunch of drillers into space instead of training astronauts how to drill? You know, that whole thing. So it's a very typical fare from what Jerry Bruckheimer was doing in the 90s.
You're absolutely right. He didn't direct this either, by the way.
Okay, that's fair. Well, he produced both of those movies.
Yes, he did produce both of them. And my criticisms aren't necessarily to say that I dislike the movie. I think the movie is a lot of fun, and I've seen this movie a bunch of times. And so I think it's a fun, silly ride.
It's a popcorn movie, and like, it's superficial in almost every aspect, and that's fine. That's what it was designed to be, for me anyway.
But this was directed by Simon West. This was his first feature film that he directed. Prior to this, he had directed a few shorts as well as a Budweiser commercial.
I mean, the direction did never really stood out at any part to me as something exceptional, so you know, it's fine. I'm not surprised hearing that as somebody that had only directed Budweiser commercials up to that point.
Now, Ray, to put somebody in your corner here, John Cusack hates this movie so much he apparently refuses to talk about it.
Cool. Okay. I mean, he's probably seen it, so that makes sense.
Wow.
I mean, I thought it was funny.
No, I like John Cusack a lot, and even more so now. Planet ever has him back, I'm gonna have him like sign my boobs or something.
You get a Con Air shirt and have him sign it.
No.
Oh, fine. Okay, so just so that we can continue talking instead of just sighing or making, you know, whatever John Cusack jokes we're gonna make. This movie, for me, watching it as a established movie critic now for many years, it basically comes across as a vehicle just to show off Nick Cage. Like, there's several scenes of him just like working out or like hanging on with something like a perfect 90 degree angle where his bicep is bulging. And he did get pretty yoked for this role. I mean, he was pretty jacked. But watching it now, I can see all these shots where it's specifically to show off Nicolas Cage's yoked physique. And I'm not sure if that was like the director or if that's Nick Cage going, look, man, I put a lot of work into my body. Can we just like have some flexing shots, or what it was? Or if it's Jerry Bruckheimer going, we need a guy that's greased up and shiny and flexing, you know? I don't know, but it was wonderful.
There are reports that it was a big deal for him to get into that shape. And so he would continuously work out off camera to keep up, like keep his muscles pumped up for the shots.
And I believe it.
This is a very gif-able movie, right? Like, you guys know that I use a lot of gifs from this movie, specifically the one where he gets off the bus and he kind of is just like, you know, smiling at the sky with his hair waving. And then there's the wink that he does later on in the movie. Like, I use those all the time. So it definitely is like the Nick Cage reel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it is.
You know,
they set him up with so many one-liners too, that were like, it felt like an 80s movie, right? Because of the one-liners and like the super yoked main character that in the lack of depth, it felt very like 80s to me, but in those respects.
Yeah, this was a big time for him. Like, keep in mind, so this year he also did Face Off. The year before, in 96, he did The Rock, which we covered a few weeks ago. So this was like peak Nick Cage right here.
It's true. Well, some people would argue that right now is peak Nick Cage.
What, Jiu-Jitsu? Jiu-Jitsu
and Mandy and some of the other movies he's been in. Jiu-Jitsu maybe not, but Mandy was supposedly very good. I still have yet to see it, but...
Mom and Dad.
He's done some nice indie stuff lately, I think. So, I don't know. Yeah, it depends which era. That's the great thing about Cage is you have so many different Cages within one lifetime, you know? You have 90s Cage, you have like indie film Cage, you have Ghost Rider Cage, which is his own weird breed of Nick Cage, but yeah.
That's fair. That's fair. So, you know, but Nick Cage, of course, like he's the lead and all, but you also have a pretty big role from John Malkovich. And like, has he ever played a role where he's not some cerebral, super intelligent portrayed person?
No.
Being John Malkovich.
He plays like every role there.
Yeah, that's true.
It's like, he was specifically stupid a lot of the time in that too. Like, you know, that role, you know, that I actually really like that movie. I'd love to review that sometime, but yeah, that's the only one I can think of though. He's always the same character, but he is great. I love John Malkovich. So, you know, I would watch him in anything practically.
The thing that like really drove me nuts is he's very intelligent. He's very thorough. And even he wrote on the box in the prison cell, "Do not open." And after John Cusack tells the guy, "No, don't touch anything," the idiot has to open the box that says, "Don't open."
Yeah, but you realize that we're in the middle of a pandemic that is getting worse because people aren't wearing a piece of fabric over their face to save other people's lives. Like, that's not that crazy, right?
Yeah, I guess you're right.
People are stupid.
It's fair.
People are stupid.
People are stupid.
Including that guy. Like, you know, it is what it is. It's believable.
Fair enough.
One thing that I think, another thing that I picked up watching this movie now is that literally everybody in this movie is like, all the men, which is basically 99% of the movie, is like one extreme or the other extreme, and there's nothing in the middle. You're either like a piece of shit, worst guy in the world, like, wants to kill everybody, or you're so far Boy Scouty like that it's almost unbelievable how great of a person you are. And in the middle is like, there's nothing.
Yeah. I mean, they really do portray Nick Cage as like, he's the hero, right? He's the hero in almost every movie he's ever done. And the movie starts off with sending him to prison, but they have to paint it all in such a way, right, to make him the real good guy at the end of the day. They were like, we want Nick Cage to be on a prison plane. And someone was like, whoa, how did he end up on a prison plane?
Yeah, what did he do? What's like the most heroic thing he can do? He can save his girlfriend, but kill a guy while he's doing it.
Basically, yeah.
By the way, the action, not all the action, but the actual fights in this movie were terrible, horrible. There were so many cuts. It was like cut, 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 cut. And I was like, oh, this is painful to watch now.
The one, I can't remember the dude's name, but it's the one that's under in the belly of the plane.
Oh, God.
Where they have to like fight, like crouch down, and they
that could have been a really cool fight scene too. Like anytime Jackie Chan and was it Shanghai Knights? I think it was. He has a scene like that where he's underneath the train, and it's a very limited space, and you can do really cool creative choreography there. But yeah, we commented on that same fight. We were like, "This is terrible. What is going on?"
I mean, it shows that, you know, Jackie Chan is very special, and some of the stuff we've had recently, like in Daredevil, we've maybe gotten a little bit spoiled now, because back in the 90s, nobody cared about that stuff.
No.
Ray, was there any character that you liked in any real capacity?
John Malkovich.
Yeah. Cyrus, okay. The virus. You like the racist guy?
No, I didn't like the racism. I like the delivery John Malkovich had with all of his lines.
Yeah, he always, is it the same delivery? Maybe I'm just not as perceptive to that. Doesn't he do that same thing with like every character though?
He does, but for some reason it just worked for this.
For and Cyrus? Maybe
it's because nobody else worked. Like, Diamond Dog should have worked. He had a very interesting story. But Ving Rhames was somehow like the absolute worst he's ever been for me. I don't understand it. It was just
Danny
bad.
Trejo, this was like actually one of his first movies that he did. And he was yoked too. That dude got jacked for this movie. But I don't think he would take that role anymore.
No.
He's come out against that kind of stuff. He likes the wholesome roles now.
He's playing like grandpas. It's super cute.
It's great.
Well, it goes to show you how, like, early on in your career, a lot of the times you feel like you have to take any role that you're offered and audition for any role that's available just to get your name out there. And then, yeah, when you become on the level that he is now, right, where he is, like, his own brand at this point, now he can do whatever he wants to do.
And that may be it. It also may be that, like, being a rapist in a movie in the 90s wasn't going to mark you. You know, now there are quite a few roles where you'll get typecast as that guy or something.
Yeah, that's fair. There's a guy in an episode of Star Trek Voyager who plays a Nazi, and that's like the only I've seen him in two roles, and they're both Nazi roles, right?
That's like a bad typecast. Like, yeah,
right. You just kind of get like stuck in that. So I mean, it's good that Danny didn't. Right. Because I really like a lot of his more recent stuff, and I like him as a person, like as his persona that he puts on and all that. So
honestly, like I don't want to take anything away from Danny Trejo because he's obviously such a fun guy and a good actor. But I kind of give credit to the fact that his cousin is Robert Rodriguez and puts him in all of his movies. So not only was he in, you know, From Dusk Till Dawn and some of the more like all the mariachi trilogy, but he was also in, you know, Spy Kids and that really helps, you know. You get a bit of both.
Yeah, and his character in this movie was just like, there's nothing redeemable. He's just a giant piece of shit. Like,
yeah,
I hated him, you know. I've hated him every time. I love Danny Trejo, but you know, in this role, it's really easy to hate him. And but I did like that John Malkovich was—he may be a piece of crap too, but at least he doesn't allow that kind of thing to happen around him.
Yeah,
you know, he has rules.
It is interesting. Like, he loses his arm in the crash, right? His arm gets torn from his body, and I thought
that was a really cool shot.
Yeah, that was shocking. Even rewatching it now, I had forgotten that when they pulled his body and his arm was hanging there, I was like, "Oh shit, that's crazy."
I like it because this is a rated R movie, obviously. So they easily could have just shown the gore of his arm ripping off or the arm like hanging.
But that scene was much better without that.
Right. Exactly. Like,
that's
sometimes
why I said it was a good shot. Yeah. Like, I was pretty impressed with that because that has true artistry behind it. And there's not a ton of the shots. Like, this film was not shot with art in mind.
But I mean, have you seen the breeze blowing camera in Poe's hair? I mean, in every scene, that's pretty artsy, if you ask me. And somehow,
yeah,
even on the plane,
no breeze anywhere.
Somehow,
yet,
his hair is still
flowing.
Yeah. So one thing that bothered me on this rewatch is that the guy that's his friend, that the diabetic guy, we don't know why he was in jail. That's never, unless I just missed it, that's never said. And so, you know, we're supposed to think that like Nicolas Cage is a good guy that did a bad thing, but for the right reason. But this other guy, that guy could be a rapist or a murderer, you know, or a child molester or whatever. We have no idea. But just because he's Nicolas Cage's friend, we don't know.
I mean, we're supposed to believe in the integrity of Poe. Right. So we're supposed to believe whatever this guy did, it couldn't have been that bad, but it was bad enough to get him sent to this new high security prison.
Yeah. And on a plane with like all the worst people in the world.
But then I got, why is Poe on that plane too, right? Like, that's where the disconnect starts to happen, you know? And so, like, him staying on to, like, save the guard's life, that's a pretty easy sell, right? The guard is supposedly a good guy, right? This was the 90s where that's that the cops were always the heroes. Things are a lot more gray now. And so his buddy, though, we don't really get those answers, but I think we're just supposed to assume.
Yeah, I mean, it stood out a little bit to me in this. And maybe that's nitpicky too, but it was, you know, if we're supposed to root for this guy living, then mm-hmm. give us a reason to want him to live other than, well, this character thinks he's okay. You know what I mean? Throwaway line is all it would take.
He had a throwaway line about how he's never going to see a parole letter. Mm-hmm. And that is not a good sign.
Right. Yeah, there is that. Yeah, I forgot about that.
It's a really good point, right? Because what did he do that has no chance of parole, but still okay enough for us to, like, think Poe should be risking his life and his freedom on this dude?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Maybe the dude got drummed up on some BS drug charges or something, and, you know, racism in the system was involved. But none of that's ever explained, right? We have to make those leaps ourselves.
Yeah.
So that's definitely fair. I had remembered Steve Buscemi's part being larger in my head because it's a very iconic character of his for me. It's always really there. And then I rewatch it and he's so minimized in this movie. It's almost unnecessary to have him.
He's not a cameo. He's just, like, right above it.
Right. It's almost like, why was that put into the movie?
Because he really only seemed like he was there for quips.
He was there for quips. He has that weird trailer park scene with the girl and supposedly leaves her totally fine and ends up in Vegas. Is he turning over a new leaf? Is that what we're supposed to believe?
No, see, at the end of the movie, I was like, oh, great. So everything's resolved except for this guy that butchered 30 families is now free in Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
but he's the funny one, so it's cool.
But is he fun? Like, does he make a joke anywhere in there? His character is, like, super serious and talking about how insanity is, like, living a normal life and doing a job for 40 years and then dying on your own or whatever.
I like his irony line, you know, when they're listening to Sweet Home Alabama on the plane and everything. I think that's a fun line.
Yeah, yeah, that one's a good one, I guess.
But otherwise, yeah. I mean, but it's such a weird character because when he leaves the plane and plays with the girl, you're supposed to at first, I guess, believe that he killed her. But then she's totally fine. He's taken the doll with him. And then he's just, like, gambling in Vegas, drinking a Bloody Mary, like, everything's cool. So, like, what are we supposed to take away from his story?
Yeah, he doesn't really add anything to the movie other than Steve Buscemi is a fun actor and having him be the scariest person on the plane is kind of a joke in itself.
Yeah. I think he was there for added tension.
But... yeah, and it did do that. That was successful. You're probably right about that.
But my problem is they added a lot of people for, like, raising the bar. I think that's my biggest problem with this is, like, each act of the movie is highly disconnected and there's not, like, Nicolas Cage's story is the same throughout the whole thing, but nobody else's is. And they introduce new characters throughout the entire film, which is a big no-no for the most part. Like, it's, you don't really do it because it doesn't add anything. It just complicates things for no reason. And all of a sudden, the South American drug lord who has zero bearing on the film. Like, the only reason they did that is so they could have yet another shootout. And when you have the shootout and two plane crashes and multiple people getting caught on fire, like, it was a lot. And I think that whole scene before they take off from Lerner could have been, like, well, it was many scenes, but it could have been cut down.
I did like the scene with Poe and the older gentleman that was hiding under the car.
Yeah,
that was a good character establishing mm-hmm. moment. You know, I liked that. But yeah, I mean, I definitely agree that like the especially the third act is a little disconnected. Like the whole plane crashing into Vegas thing seems like it was tacked on just to like have a certain number of crashes in the movie to make it a 90s action flick. I mean, the movie was
Blow Our Budget 101.
Yeah, I mean, the movie was pretty good up until that point, but it kind of went off the rails at that. You know, when you got freaking Nicolas Cage hanging off a fire truck going after Cyrus while this other dude is driving, and then John Cusack is sneaking up behind and like trying to flood the front of the fire. Like, there's just so much going on. It was just over the top. And then nobody cares that Cameron Poe is stealing a police bike.
Nope.
You know, and riding it like a crazy person through the streets of Vegas.
That's the thing too, is like he goes from even defending himself is a legitimate crime that's going to get him almost a decade in prison to, oh yeah, take the cruiser if you're going to try and stop a bad guy, it's fine.
Also, John Malkovich basically turns into Rasputin at the end of the movie, where he's like, we're going to kill him by like chaining him to this ladder and then slamming him into the top of a tunnel. Well, that doesn't kill him. Somehow he gets slung through the tunnel while still keeping his hand and arm intact and flies through that, then lands on some electrical poles. But that's not going to kill him. Then he's going to fall into what? I don't even remember how he ended up dying. Didn't he fall into some water or something?
No, got drowned? He lands on this thing underneath a piston.
Oh, that's right. And it crushes his head.
I don't know what the piston is doing.
Yeah, it's smashing something. We don't. And why is it next to like this bridge?
I don't know.
The whole thing is just weird.
It started to lose me in the desert when the good guy, the cavalry, show up and voluntarily basically go into a valley, which is like military 101 type stuff, right? Like this is in the middle of nowhere, a desert, and you're just gonna come in through this one spot that's fortifiable. It was
a cool scene though. So I mean, yes, yeah. it was stupid, but it was a cool action scene, and so I give it that, you know, at the very least. But you're definitely right.
That's fair. It's just the whole thing's just kind of, it comes off a little silly because like Colmini's character the whole time is just flying off the handle. He's refusing to listen to everybody. And even after making the mistake of flying like 300 miles out of their way or whatever he said it was to track the wrong plane, he's still not listening later on in the movie. And it's just like, that's a device.
After this whole fucking thing is his fault anyway.
Exactly. And that type of device is used a lot, right? Where like if people just listened for 5 seconds, the movie would be over. It gets a little old sometimes. And this was just another example of that mechanic, that device.
So Rachel, you've said a lot of things that you hated about this movie. But was there anything that you hated more? That's right. That's true. But was there anything you hated more than Nicolas Cage's accent in this movie?
Oh God, it's so bad. And
but it's so bad, it's good, right? No, like,
when it flashes Mobile, Alabama at the very beginning, I turned to Derek and I was like, he's going to have a dumbass accent, isn't he? And Derek's like, how do you even know that already? And I was like, just
because you know Nicolas Cage, like, he loves to experiment, right? He'll pick a random ass voice or accent, and then that's the way he's going to be the whole movie. And if you're the director, you either deal with that or you don't have Nicolas Cage.
Yeah,
that's just how he is. And he definitely went really far with this one.
Since this guy's like first movie, you know, that guy was like, maybe you don't sound like that. And
Nick is like, no, I definitely do.
Yeah.
Cameron Poe, this is what he sounds like.
In a really, really dumb accent, Nicolas Cage is like, how about you suck my dick? And he walks off.
Basically. And he's wearing a wife beater at the time.
Yeah. He's like, I have an Oscar. What do you have? A Budweiser commercial? Fuck off.
Yeah, I was going to play Superman, bitch.
All right. So, go ahead.
I have a weird comparison, and you guys will never hear this again. But this movie kind of did The Return of the King, where it had 8 different endings for no damn reason. And like, you'll never hear Con Air be
compared to
Lord of the Rings, but
that's
so Con. So basically, Con Air is the 1990s version of Return of the King.
Does that mean Face Off is Two Towers? I guess we'll find out once Rachel watches Face Off.
So wait, The Rock is the Fellowship.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay,
Rachel, I'm gonna be honest with you. I think Face Off is a better movie than Con Air. So
I can't. I'm going to be pregnant that episode.
No, Rachel, I'm being honest. John Woo directed it, and he does, at the very least, amazing action scenes. So there's at least something that you can look forward to.
How many doves are in that movie?
A lot. There's a lot of doves. It's John Woo. And there's a lot of gun, like, action, like John Wick type stuff. But, I mean, I think that it's worth watching for the action alone. But Nick Cage goes way off the deep end in this movie. So it's even better if you're for the love of Cage, like we all are this holiday.
I saw the trailer.
It is rated slightly higher on IMDb.
Oh, see? Thank you.
I'm telling you, it's a better movie. I love Con Air, but I would watch Face Off over Con Air, like, 8 out of 10 times.
All right, so we still have to talk The Mandalorian. So is there anything else on Con Air that you guys want to talk about before we bounce?
I want to thank Rachel for bearing with it. And I know that it was painful for you, but I hope you found something redeeming in it and feel that your life is a little more full having seen it now.
All right, then that's what we're going to do. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we are talking The Mandalorian Chapter 14, The Tragedy. So this is your spoiler warning for The Mandalorian. We'll be right back. All right, we're back. Let's do this. Let's talk The Mandalorian Chapter 14, The Tragedy. So I think this was the shortest episode of The Mandalorian that we've had so far, clocked in at just about 35 minutes, but people love it. 9.4 on IMDb. This is your spoiler warning. Directed by Robert Rodriguez, which is cool.
Yeah.
Very cool. And of course, we got the big reveal of the return of Boba Fett. Thoughts, musings, anecdotes.
I didn't like it as much as the previous episode, but it definitely was a strong episode overall. Probably those two episodes are probably some of the best in the series. So, you know, Boba for me was never as big of an interest of a character as a lot of other Star Wars fans. I don't know why, he just never really appealed to me that much, but it was cool seeing him be, it was kind of like Rogue One, where we got to see Vader actually like be a badass, because in the original trilogy, you never really got to see him be a badass. You were like, why is everybody scared of this guy? But then Rogue One kind of fixed that. You got to see why everybody was scared of him. And this was kind of like Boba Fett's version of that on a smaller scale. You got to see him using his knee rockets, which is something we haven't seen before. You just heard about. You got to see him use his backpack rocket, which was cool. You know, you got to see him fight, and the way he fought with that gaffy stick was, as a fan of action, you know, I was loving. I the first time I saw a stormtrooper armor like shatter over the ground, I squealed a little bit, being honest. I was so excited to see that.
Yeah, he was pretty impressive.
I agree.
It's about damn time.
Yes, it was.
I'm with you there. The armor shattering was super cool. I don't know that we've seen that before in Star Wars.
We haven't. That's why it was so cool, because you know that their armor is basically for nothing, because one laser blast and they die. And, you know, now you see getting shattered with a gaffy stick is a better way to die if you're armored, because it's more believable, right? But what's the armor even for if a blaster shot kills you, you know? It's not that protective against a gaffy stick either, so.
It's, I think the armor is there to hide that everybody is not the same person.
I guess, but, you know, that's a stupid reason to have armor. They waste a lot of money. That's a lot of expense. The shareholders are not going to be happy about that.
I liked most of the episode. Grogu's bit was pretty cool. I liked that we actually kind of see him use some significant force abilities, and it was clearly very powerful because Mando couldn't touch him and he was getting thrown pretty far. Now maybe that's not just Grogu, maybe it's part of that spot.
Yeah, I think I took that as more of like that's the spot, the seeing stone or seer stone or whatever. Yeah. It was kind of, that's its thing. But it was interesting, though, you know, and the fact that like Mando could bend it a little bit. Does that mean that, like, you know, what does that mean? Is that just anybody can bend it because it's just an energy, or is that like a force related thing? You know, it raises some questions.
I just took it as his determination of pushing in as much as possible, because like the Force isn't literally like a solid wall, right? It's based on whatever it's emanating from, you know. It's still got a limit, so I just figured he was just really determined.
Sure, but like when you think of like a sci-fi force field, you know, it's basically made up of the same kind of thing. It's just an energy wall, and a lot of times that's portrayed as something that just, you know, is a wall essentially of energy. It can't be bent. So, you know, it was interesting to me that this one could be bent.
But I don't think Mando is force sensitive.
I don't think he is either, but you know, it just raises questions as to like exactly what this shield is for.
I'll probably be pretty disappointed if it turns out he is force sensitive.
I don't think he is. I'm not implying that at all.
No, but I've seen a few people post stuff like that. Like they want him to find out that he's force sensitive, and then they train together or something like that. And I don't want to see that personally.
Yeah, that would be lame.
That's just me though. What are they called the Death Troopers? No, that's not Death Troopers. What were they called? The Dark Troopers. The Death Troopers were in Rogue One.
Iron Men.
Exactly. I was going to say, Favreau loves his Iron Man suits.
The Iron Men that were in existence before Iron Man came out. I mean, they were from a Dark Forces video game, and that came out before Iron Man, so.
Well, not before the character of Iron Man.
No, but before the movies, before Jon Favreau was ever involved, and he didn't really change the look. It looks pretty much just like it did in the video game, so.
I was just joking around because it was
whatever, like, Derek. Don't try and step on fanboys' toes.
That effect that's used is the exact same effect that was used on all the Ultron copies in Avengers. You know?
I'm gonna go against the grain here and say I was actually disappointed in the Dark Troopers because you don't get to see them do shit. Like you're bringing them up to be this badass thing that Moff Gideon is making specifically like to protect him or do whatever he wants, and then all they do is go down to the ground, walk really slowly, and then jetpack off to a ship.
Picked up a baby.
Picked up a baby without crushing it. So that's pretty impressive.
Right. Like, I was expecting them to come down like while the wall was still up and having to like force their way through and maybe getting damaged in the process, or like maybe not all of them survived.
That would have
been
better, I think. I don't know. I would have liked to see them all survive, but that would show how powerful they are. If Mando could bend it but couldn't get into it, but then they had a way of, you know, piercing the wall. That would have made him pretty scary without having to show him any combat or anything like that.
Yeah. I mean, you could have had him like damaged in the process, like parts of the casing, you know, peeled off or whatever. I did like having Grogu throwing around the stormtroopers a little bit when he was all pissed off.
Yeah, that was wonderful.
Thought that was pretty good. It kind of shows what Ahsoka was worried about too, though. Like, you know, he's got some darkness in him, and you know,
he was just kidnapped. Like, Ahsoka went through and murdered all those people, so she can suck it.
Whoa. I wasn't making like a judgment on him being wrong.
No, I know you weren't. I'm not mad at you.
Okay. Cool.
I'm not mad at anybody. They're fictional characters.
I've been mad at fictional characters.
I'm mad at part of this episode. The jetpack.
Okay.
So it's been established that he can control the jetpack with his arm, right? Why, when he set it down or whatever, did he not just, like, when he's running to go rescue the child, summon the jetpack to come over and, like, attach to him and take him up, you know? Because then he could have bypassed that entire thing. It's just annoying to me that they give him a power set, you know, that he can use, and then they strip him of that for the sake of the plot in this movie. It reminds me of The Flash, where he's only fast enough, you know, for the plot to progress. And I hate that.
Yeah. I don't even know why they wanted him to take the jetpack off. Cause like Boba didn't have to take his jetpack off.
Because it's establishing, you know, that's how they're going to set up the rest of the episode. And right. It was just a lazy bit of plot, and it never shows him actually getting the jetpack. Did he leave a giant Beskar jetpack on the planet?
I'm assuming he picks it up.
Right. But he probably used his controls to like just bring it to him, so he didn't have to walk that far. So why didn't he just do that before? That whole thing bothered me quite a bit. It was just that part was just straight up lazy, you know, storytelling, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a big part of his character, and it's a big power. Like, that's one of his big powers. So it's frustrating.
It's a silly thing. I mean, at least, like, you could have just had him leave it on the ship.
Right. Or there's any number of things they could have done that would have been better, I think. But yeah.
There's a lot of problems with the way that was handled. There was a lot of solutions to it as well. And, you know, so his ship's destroyed.
Which was sad.
Right.
But seeing Slave One again was cool.
Seeing the Slave One was super cool. That was great. That begs some interesting questions, like nobody took it when Boba Fett supposedly died.
He just had a lot of garage fees for it.
You know, I don't know.
He had a lot of tickets. he was double parked, so he had a lot of tickets. But
you know, it's been quite a few years, so maybe he spent most of his time getting his, you know, ship back.
Yeah, or maybe he just like really likes that model, so he went and bought a second one to replace it afterwards. Yeah. And so he just called it the Slave One so nobody would doubt it.
Fair enough. That works for me. That's good enough. Having Mando's ship destroyed, like, it's funny, like, it's supposed to be sad, you know, but like he just went through all the trouble of getting it fixed. And so like that just seems like just a waste.
Let me tell you who I feel the most sorry for. With regards to this situation, the people that all contributed a ton of money to Hasbro's essentially a Kickstarter to get a giant Razor Crest model, because now that ship is gone, he's probably going to get a cooler ship, if not the Slave One. And these people all just spent like $300 for a giant Razor Crest model.
Giant yikes.
I mean, that's a fair point, but he had it for more than a season and a half.
Sure, but you know, maybe they want a $300 model of the new ship instead, but now they've already pledged, you know, that money.
All I can say is welcome to the Star Trek franchise. I mean,
how did I know you were going to bring Trek in for the fourth time this episode?
Second time.
Whatever, I haven't been counting.
You should try.
Right.
These aren't very high numbers. Anything else on this short micro episode of The Mandalorian?
Seeing Ming-Na Wen back was good. She's great on it and everything I've seen her in, so I really enjoyed having her. And her cyborg stomach was really cool. I'm going to have one of those installed, I think.
That thing is awesome.
I'm curious how that works, because I didn't get like a great look at it. Is it replacing like the bottom half of her body, or is it like an insert and her body has been put on either side?
They don't really show it well enough to know exactly.
Yeah,
it looked like pistons moving up and down, so I'm going
like a Terminator.
I'm going to assume that it's just replaced the function of her stomach. And maybe she no longer has to eat or something like that. Okay. I don't know. I know in my heart of hearts that everything will be fine, but I swear to God, if anything happens to that stupid puppet, I will lose.
You will stop buying all Star Wars merchandise for the rest of your life.
I will rage on this world.
Wow, you're gonna go full barbarian, huh?
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, who do you think the Jedi is gonna be that shows up?
It's tough to say, man. I mean, I'd like it to be Luke, but I know that that's pretty unlikely.
Played by Sebastian Stan.
Played by whoever. I don't care. Mark Hamill, Sebastian Stan, either one would be fine. But
I know a ton of people are predicting Ezra Bridger.
Yeah, that would be cool. I don't know a lot about him because, you know, I haven't watched the kids' shows. I'm just more of a basic fan that doesn't really read into anything other than the movies. So, you know, I probably wouldn't appreciate it as much if he showed up, but,
you casual,
I'm just a filthy casual because I don't watch the shows on Disney XD, but, I think it could be, I liked his lightsaber. That was also a blaster. I mean, I don't even know. Does he still have that? Filthy casual doesn't know anything about that kind of stuff. So
it's Star Wars. He can have anything at any time.
That's true.
I don't know. I had five guys tell me how to pronounce the name just before the episode.
Ezra Bridger?
Yeah.
How did you think it was? How did you think it was pronounced?
Ezra Bridger.
Wow, that sounds about right. That's because you're a woman. I don't know if you knew that, but yeah. That's, yeah, common with women. Yeah, only men really know the way to pronounce that name. So, or really anything in Star Wars. So you should probably just ask. before
from
you,
now on.
Yeah, yeah, try and pronounce any names.
Yeah, for sure.
Fantastic. Well, my guess is Obi-Wan.
Yeah.
Because yeah. McGregor was on set, supposedly doing test footage
for the
Obi-Wan show in his Jedi robes. And that's all cute, but I think that's BS.
Right. So you think that he's just going to come back to life and go and get the baby?
As a Force ghost?
Can Force ghosts physically interact with an object?
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to imply that the Jedi that shows up saves Grogu. I just meant they call the Jedi and the Jedi is going to show up.
You think as a Force ghost, Obi-Wan is going to come to Grogu and train him?
I think that that's going to be the question. I think he's going to not do it.
What's the point of him even showing up? Because Ahsoka already said she wasn't going to do it.
I don't think anyone's going to train him.
Yet another backdoor pilot.
Yeah.
Do
you guys kind of get the feeling that they're creating like the Star Wars Magnificent Seven here?
Yeah. Every time they're like a backdoor pilot, you know, Ahsoka's going to get a spinoff and then this other guy's going to get a spinoff. And what's her name? That's the Twitter troll is going to get a spinoff. Yeah. You know, it's like, it does hamper it a little bit for me. Even if I like those characters, I don't want this show to just be like Arrow where characters show up to see if they're good for everything else.
But at least we already know Obi-Wan is getting his own show. So
I guess I don't think that means he needs to be here though.
I'm not saying he needs to be. I just think it's easy.
Why is everything in the entire Star Wars universe revolving around Obi-Wan and Skywalkers? Why does it all have to be that way? You know,
let's make a
new Jedi. Let's introduce a new Jedi and then he can get a spinoff. You know, and then you can have an Obi-Wan spinoff, an Ahsoka spinoff, and a spinoff of this other cool Jedi that you're going to introduce. You know, yeah. I'd watch a spinoff with the IG droid voiced by Taika. That, you know,
here's the problem.
More interesting characters.
The problem here is simple. If you actually get a Jedi to show up and train Grogu, then Mando has to go on his own without him. And I don't think anybody at the studio wants to write that show
anymore.
That's
not true. Why does that have to be the case? Why can't the Jedi just travel with him? Obi-Wan was training Luke while they were traveling.
Yeah, no, it's not impossible, obviously. I just, you know.
Well, that's what you said. That was the problem.
Because it changes the whole dynamic of the show. Because it's a Western right now, right? That focuses on this Mandalorian. And he's like the Mando dad and everything. If you bring in a Jedi, like as a regular character, that's going to overshadow everything.
That's why Ezra would be a good fit, because Ezra, if he was, as far as I understand it, being not somebody who's watched the shows, I thought he was more like a rebel than a Jedi. He was not like, you know, he was like Mara Jade in the expanded universe. That was not a Jedi first.
He's much more
first and then a Jedi second. So somebody like that would fit in.
That's an pretty interesting easily
point. With Mando, you know, there's been a lot of characters like that in the Star Wars canon and non-canon. So I think they could bring somebody like that in and it would fit just fine. It wouldn't really change the dynamic.
Yeah, no, that's fair. He's much more like Han.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Get somebody like Han, but that's also a Jedi. But he's like Han first. The smuggler is the most important thing and he only uses the Jedi stuff when he has to. You know, that's more interesting to me.
That's fair.
Good talk.
Mm-hmm.
Ray, anything you want to add?
No. I've said the stuff that I was thinking.
That's good.
Do you think the show would be enhanced by Cameron Poe showing up and being a regular character?
Poe Dameron?
No, I'm saying Cameron Poe.
Poe Dameron.
I want Cameron Poe to show up on a plane that's full of enemies of the Republic or something like that.
That'd
be amazing.
Donnie Yen.
Yeah, series. That'd be cool.
Like,
do you think he could carry his own series?
I think he could do a small one, like
a limited run, like
the Marvel
six
shows. Like, yeah. Yeah, I do. Because I think he was an interesting character that should have been a main character in a film, but unfortunately was. He overshadowed like what everybody else was. And that was unfortunate because, you know, the other characters in Rogue One are great and they work really well together, but he could have worked really well by himself.
Yeah, I agree with that. I don't know that he could carry like a long running show like Mando, but definitely a short, you know, short run show to kind of flesh out his character would be definitely pretty cool.
I just want to know what he was doing for like the 5 years before we meet him.
Yeah, I'd be on board for that.
Yeah, fair enough. All right, well then I think this is a good place to stop, guys. It's a good place to stop.
We're only 20 minutes over. Woo!
Anyway, we, of course, are the Screen Heroes podcast. Next week, we are going to be talking Ghost Rider as we continue our Merry Cagemas for everybody. And we'll also talk Chapter 15 of The Mandalorian, whatever they end up calling that episode, since they don't tell us. We can be found on the Twitterverse at Screen Heroes Pod. You can find us at heroespodcast.com where you can stream the show or you can subscribe on any number of podcast apps, including Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts, as well as many, many more. You can find our link tree and get all that goodness. Drop us a review. If you review us, then we will read your review on the show and give you a shout out. We would appreciate that. It helps people find the show. So please review us if you can. Ray, if people want to reach out to you and commiserate about why Con Air is terrible, how can they find you?
I'm at Siren Ray on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
And Ryan, if people want to talk to you about why Nick Cage is the greatest actor to ever live, how may they find you? God.
Yeah, if you want to hashtag one true God, then I'll definitely chat with you. But yeah, at Buster Props on Twitter.
And I'm at the Star Trek Dude. Thank you for listening. We are Screen Heroes on the Heroes Podcast Network. We will catch you next week. Have a good one, everybody.